Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dan Kovalik, human rights attorney and author of the book, The Plot to Attack Iran, who assesses the Trump administration's hostile stance toward Iran and the risk of miscalculation that could lead to war. Ron Fine, legal director with the group Free Speech for People, who discusses the current constitutional crisis between House Democrats and President Trump and the party's fence-sitting on impeachment. And Massachusetts State Representative Marjorie Decker and grieving mother Arminda Baptiste, who call for compassion and support for families impacted by murder while participating in the 23rd annual Mother's Day March for Peace in Boston. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A burst of violence on the Gaza Strip between Israel, Hamas, and Islamic Jihad saw the most intensive fighting since the 50-day war of 2014. 25 Palestinians and 4 Israelis were killed during 48 hours of violence, which began after a Gaza sniper shot and wounded Israeli soldiers. After Israel responded with airstrikes on targets in Gaza, Hamas and Islamic Jihad launched 600 crewed missiles into southern Israel. A ceasefire went into effect after negotiators from Egypt and the United Nations intervened. In the aftermath of the fighting, senior military commanders expressed opposition to the Gaza policies of Israel's right-wing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. According to the Christian Science Monitor, top military officers called for the easing of the economic blockade against Gaza, which has been in effect since 2007. Otherwise, the army expects cross-border violence with Hamas to resume. Meanwhile, the 2 million Palestinian residents of Gaza suffer daily shortages of food, electricity, and medical supplies. Shlomo Brahm, a former head of strategic planning for the Israeli army, observed, "We are in the worst kind of situation, where people inside the government cannot put into action sane policies because of political considerations." Netanyahu and his far-right coalition partners fear that any concessions made to Hamas will be seen by the voters who just re-elected them last month as giving in to terrorism. After 511 days in prison, two Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters, Hua Lan and Jia So-U, were released when the Myanmar government issued a broad pardon of more than 6,000 prisoners. The Reuters reporters were convicted in September of violating the colonial-era State Secrets Act. The convictions were upheld by Myanmar's Supreme Court. The reporters uncovered a massacre of Rohingya Muslims in a Rakhine State village. During the trial, a key witness testified the reporters had been entrapped. Reuters' counsel insists the two reporters committed no crime. Nearly 750,000 Rohingyas were forced to flee to Bangladesh after Myanmar's army and Buddhist villagers led a wave of violence targeting the religious and ethnic minority. Myanmar's top civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, came under intense international pressure to release the reporters who were awarded the Pulitzer Prize while they were incarcerated. Human Rights Watch hailed the release, but expressed concern over dozens of journalists and dissident bloggers who face criminal charges under repressive laws used to prosecute peaceful critics. In Maine, the state AFL-CIO became the first state labor federation to endorse Green New Deal legislation. The bill calls for 80% renewable energy by the year 2040, solar power for public schools, and a state commission to assist in planning a just transition to a low-carbon economy. The Maine bill is less ambitious than the proposed federal Green New Deal sponsored by New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The major focus in Maine is designing a clean energy transition with the backing of working-class communities. Other green bills in the Maine legislature focus on transportation and agriculture. The Maine AFL-CIO's support for the bill is an important milestone, as labor remains divided on the Green New Deal nationally. While the AFL-CIO's Energy Committee was unhappy with some of the resolution's specific language and lack of specificity, other labor unions have been more supportive. Over the last 2 months, both the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor and the Association of Flight Attendants have endorsed the Green New Deal to address the urgent issues of climate change and economic inequality. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
On May 8, 2018, President Donald Trump withdrew the United States from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, better known as the International Iran Nuclear Deal. America's unilateral pullout from the agreement came despite Iran's 100% compliance with restrictions placed on the Islamic Republic's nuclear weapons program. Now, 1 year later, Mr. Trump and his National Security Advisor John Bolton appear to be preparing for war with Iran. In quick succession, a series of events over the past week have contributed to a dangerous rise in tensions between Washington and Tehran. The White House dispatched an aircraft carrier strike group and bomber task force to the Middle East after asserting intelligence agencies were warning of a possible attack against U.S. forces or their allies by Iran or their proxies. At about the same time, Iran threatened to reduce its compliance with a nuclear agreement unless the other signatories could provide relief from U.S.-imposed sanctions. Reports of damage to four oil tankers, two of them Saudi-owned vessels, from a purported sabotage attack off the coast of the United Arab Emirates, further escalated tensions. Then the New York Times published a story maintaining that Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan presented a military plan to deploy as many as 120,000 U.S. troops to the Middle East if Iran attacked U.S. forces or accelerated work on its nuclear weapons program. Your reporter spoke with human rights attorney Dan Kovalik, author of the book The Plot to Attack Iran, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Iran. Here he assesses the Trump administration's hostile stance toward Iran and the risk of miscalculation that could lead to war.
Iran knows that a conflict would be fatal for itself. And so it's the U.S. that is ginning up a conflict. Iran was in compliance with the nuclear deal. Our own intelligence services said that. Obviously, Europe believed that because they've tried to hold on to it. And Trump walked away from it unilaterally. Why? Not because Iran wasn't complying with it, because Trump wanted a conflict with Iran. And certainly his national security advisor, John Bolton, has been very clear that he wants a war with Iran. And what we see now happening in the Persian Gulf with the U.S. sending warships there, and then with these, frankly, very vague claims of ships being sabotaged, we're seeing a pretext being developed for a war against Iran, very much like the pretext we saw in the war against Iraq in 2003, which was based on weapons of mass destruction, which ended up not existing, or like the Gulf of Tonkin incident in the 1960s, which never happened either, but which led to the U.S.'s massive invasion of Vietnam. And so we're seeing this repeated right now. It's interesting, the former Lieutenant Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who actually wrote the Yellow Cake speech for Colin Powell, the one that helped pave the way for the war in Iraq, has been very clear that he regrets having penned that speech, which was based on falsehood. And he's also clear that a war with Iran would be devastating, 10 times more devastating in terms of lives and treasure than the war with Iraq, and that we should not be pushing for such a war, and yet we seem to be hurtling towards a war with Iran right now.
Dan, it's often been reported that the Trump administration's hard line against Iran has weakened the moderates there and strengthened the hardliners. The question out there is, what is the Trump administration's goal here? Are they trying to gin up a war, or is there some other goal here that they've articulated that I missed?
I think they're trying to gin up a war. It appears to me that the neocons, again, best represented by John Bolton, have seized control of U.S. foreign policy, and they want, and have been very clear for decades, that they want to recreate the Middle East. And a big part of that is getting rid of the government in Iran. And I think the only way they think they can do it is through military force, and that's what they're pushing for. So, yeah, I mean, it's very dangerous. This is going to cost millions of lives if it happens, trillions of dollars that could be better spent on other things. But this is what some people in the White House want at this point.
Now, there's a whole range of reckless actions, propaganda gone wild, unintended consequences, miscalculations, even false flag operations that could trigger a conflict. What are you most concerned about of that and maybe others that you could add to that list?
Well, I think any military invasion of Iran would be devastating. And I think we need to be looking for these fake pretexts. Again, I think we're seeing some happen right now with claims of ships being sabotaged. You know, we send ships to the Persian Gulf looking for trouble. And my guess is somehow the U.S. is going to find trouble, either real, imagined, or made up. The problem has been that the mainstream press has been unwilling to challenge the White House, whoever's in it, when they make such claims that lead to war. And I think we need to be skeptical and to question what we're being told in regards to Iran. I believe Iran does not want a war. I think they realize they would lose a war ultimately. And I think we need to be very skeptical of any claims of the things happening that will lead to a pretext to start that war.
In this moment of rising tensions between Washington and Tehran, what, in your view, is the role of the House of Representatives controlled by the opposition party, the Democrats? What should they be doing in this moment here?
Well, what they should be doing is enforcing the War Powers Act, making it clear that Trump has no constitutional right to start a war with Iran without congressional authorization, and they should not give such authorization. People want to focus on doing something to prevent a war, it would be putting pressure on the House of Representatives to take those actions, because otherwise they won't. I mean, the Democrats, let's face it, they're not good on these issues either. Certainly once a war starts, the Democrats will jump right on board. So I think the time is now to put pressure on Democratic representatives to stand up to Trump on this.
That was Dan Kovalik, author of the book, The Plot to Attack Iran, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Iran. Find more analysis and commentary on the dangers of the Trump administration's hostile policy toward Iran by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The confrontation between House Democrats and President Trump took a new turn when, on May 8th, the House Judiciary Committee voted 24-16 to recommend that the House hold Attorney General William Barr in contempt of Congress for his failure to turn over Special Counsel Robert Mueller's unredacted report on Russian interference in the 2016 election. This came just hours after Mr. Trump asserted executive privilege to withhold the full report and underlying evidence from Congress. This was the first action by the Democratic Party-controlled House of Representatives to hold a member of the Trump administration accountable for their non-cooperation with the body's investigations. In total, 9 Trump administration officials have declined to appear before House committees. Democrats say that on 35 occasions, the administration has either refused to respond or delayed producing committee document requests, including the refusal to hand over Trump's tax returns and the filing of a lawsuit to block Deutsche Bank from responding to requests for the president's financial records. At the same time, the administration is trying to prevent former White House counsel Don McGahn and special counsel Robert Mueller from testifying before Congress. Your reporter spoke with Ron Fine, legal director with the group Free Speech for People, which, along with a coalition of other groups on May 9th, delivered to Congress 10 million petition signatures favoring the launch of an impeachment inquiry. Here he discusses the current constitutional confrontation between House Democrats and the president and the party's fence sitting on impeachment.
I think there is a real danger of the system breaking down. One of the things that I researched when we were writing our book about impeachment, The Constitution Demands It, is the impeachment proceedings against Richard Nixon, the last time that we had a serious impeachment process and one that resulted in President Nixon ultimately resigning after articles of impeachment were approved in the House Judiciary Committee. And one of the articles of impeachment against him was for his blatant defiance of congressional subpoenas for documents that were needed as part of the impeachment investigation. So a lot of people know about Watergate. That was one article of impeachment. And there was a second article of impeachment that was for other abuses of power that in some cases had nothing to do with Watergate. And the third was for this defiance of congressional oversight. So in other words, that alone is a basis for impeachment. Even when you take everything else out, that defiance of subpoenas, we have the precedent from the Nixon impeachment proceedings. And I think we're clearly headed in that direction with President Trump, that even when you set everything else aside, if he is really serious about what he said about fighting all of the subpoenas just on a blanket level, using every possible means available to him, including he's actually suing Representative Cummings and his committee for attempting to subpoena financial records. If President Trump is going down this path, then that's going to become an entirely independent ground for impeachment.
But when we talk about the likelihood that our system is failing now in relation to checks and balances, what is the cure for that? Do we only rely on courts to settle the score here and to come up with a fair resolution? Or are there no means to hold this president accountable?
I think Congress has, in recent years, and certainly since the inauguration of President Trump, relied too much on courts and not enough on its own power. When the framers were creating the constitutional design, they created three branches, each able to check the others. And they didn't say that Congress needs to run to the judiciary every time they have a serious dispute with the president. Rather, Congress has power to check the president on its own if they use it. So they have tools that they are not fully using, including, of course, the full power of impeachment and removal. But I think they're a little hesitant, and they're waiting to get a blessing or an indication from a judge or set of judges that they can point to so that they don't necessarily have to own the decision themselves. And a great example of that is the president's violation of the Constitution's emoluments clauses. These are clauses in the Constitution that prohibit the president from taking funds from foreign governments or even from federal state governments. And in the case of foreign governments, it's a complete prohibition unless Congress specifically consents to a particular emolument from a foreign government. But Congress has not taken direct action on it. Instead, some members of Congress have filed a lawsuit, which is proceeding well in court, but it means that they've basically outsourced their power to deal with it directly, for example, by impeachment, to a court waiting for a judge to say that that it's wrong. And in fact, the trial judge has said that, but by the time it gets all the way through potential appeals and to the Supreme Court, a lot of time will have passed. And it's just indicative of how Congress could be taking much more direct action for checks and balances instead of relying on the courts to do its work for it.
Ron, if impeachment is not carried out against President Trump, what are the short-term and long-term consequences for our government, our system of checks and balances, and the behavior of future presidents?
Well, in the short term, Donald Trump will read that message as, Congress is nothing. And I think from the fact that Congress did nothing against the emoluments violations when he came into office, he concluded that he could get away with virtually anything. And so far he is. He's faced no accountability. So I think he will see that as weakness and exploit it. And he will become increasingly authoritarian now that he knows that he is not going to face any consequences. In the long term, future presidents will take the same lesson, that they can get away with more than Richard Nixon got away with, and that they won't face consequences as long as they can rally a small base to defend them. Future presidents might be more disciplined and focused than President Trump, and will be able to, and will be not only as authoritarian in impulse, but also more focused in executing those plans. And I think we will really see autocracy on the rise in America if the House does not take a stand and start an impeachment investigation against President Trump.
That was Ron Fine, legal director with the group Free Speech for People, and co-author of the book, The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. Find more views on the debate over impeachment by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Mother's Day 2019 marked the 23rd consecutive Lewis D. Brown Walk for Peace in Boston. Lewis was a high-achieving student with lofty goals who worked to end violence in his community. At age 15, he was killed, caught in the crossfire of a gang shootout, while on his way to a Teens Against Gang Violence meeting. His mother, Tina Cherry, founded the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute to promote the goals her son had begun working toward. On a cold, rainy day, May 12th, hundreds of people of all ages, genders, and backgrounds walked through the Dorchester and Roxbury neighborhoods to a rally at Boston City Hall. They walked in unity for peace and healing, while demanding dignity and compassion for all families impacted by murder. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus participated in the walk and spoke with this year's honorary co-chair, Massachusetts State Representative Marjorie Decker, as well as several family members of loved ones who were lost to violence. Here, Decker explains the origins of the Institute, formed out of grief, that became a place for families to receive supportive services and address the root causes of violence, including easy access to guns.
They do really important community-based work that provides essential services that are very specific to dealing with the loss of loved ones who've been murdered, and in particular children. But they also play a really important role through their programming in fostering peace, trading up violence for social and economic justice. And I'm here because it's really important that we do not lean on our nonprofits or the grief of those who are survivors of homicide to do all the work that's important to the rest of us. You know, loss and grief is not something that stays with just a family. It impacts entire neighborhoods, communities, schools. So many of our schools are carrying the trauma of homicide and violence, and it is our responsibility collectively as individuals, every single one of us, and as local and state governments, to step in and support the work and take their lead.
So as a state rep, is there anything directly that you can do or have done to promote that?
I led the bill that was signed into law last year, the Red Flag Bill. Extreme risk protection. It means that if you know somebody in your family, in your home, has a gun and they're going to hurt themselves or hurt someone else, you can now go to the courts and have them removed from their guns. So that law was passed. In that work, I also became acutely aware of the incredible support and resources people have who are working to change gun laws. But it was also really gut-wrenching to see that same level of support, both financially, emotionally, and visibly, was not there for victims and survivors of homicide. The legislature this year additionally passed targeted resources to work with young people in communities that are particularly impacted by homicide and violence. We need to have survivors on the forefront, not only while we lobby for better gun laws, but they need to be at the forefront, and we all need to be lobbying for more support for resources, because as I said, gun violence and homicides, the survivors are carrying that grief and that post-traumatic stress around. It's not isolated, right? It seeps into all parts of our communities, and it's all of us have a responsibility to make sure we're understanding the impact of trauma and how we are providing support to the immediate survivors, but recognize that that trauma impacts our schools and our communities, and it is really our responsibility to make sure we are leaning in and that our resources and our laws are actually supporting them.
What's the significance of having this on Mother's Day?
Yeah, I mean, can you think of anything more painful? I can't, as a mom of two, than to know that on Mother's Day your child has been ripped away from you by violence and is now no longer here because they've been murdered. I mean, this is really an opportunity for, I think Tina did this because of wanting to be with other grieving moms, but really wanting to provide a space for families who are grieving, and then for the rest of us as moms to say, you're not alone. Your grief cannot just be yours alone to carry, and there's no more powerful day when we think about the love of our children and the need to protect them than on Mother's Day.
Arminda Baptista's son was murdered in 2016. She was at the walk with a big team of family, friends, neighbors, and co-workers. She said she had participated in the walk even before her son was killed.
My son, AJ, was 21. Humble, loving, friendly, sweet young man who was getting a haircut at our local barbershop. And while he was sitting on the barber chair, some individual felt like he should just take his life. And my life has been totally a disaster since then.
So have you taken advantage of any services that the Peace Institute offers regarding family, you know, survivors of violence?
I've done some. It's been a little hard. I'm just getting my feet back on the ground and try to wrap myself around everything that has occurred, but I have done some with them.
What would you like to say to people who hear this about violence that takes the life of a family member?
As an individual, that you're taking the life of another individual, you actually ruin a whole family, like the siblings, the aunts, the mom, like whoever, you know, whatever your cruelty is, like against my son's at peace, but who's suffering is his family. That's the hardest part. I can't look at my kids because it's so hard because they don't have an older brother now.
I think you've done a really good job of laying out, like you said, it's not one individual against one other individual.
Nope. It's a whole family, a whole community just ruins everyone. Everyone. These individuals need more love and peace in their heart because I think that's what's missing, the hardcore of what's missing.
That was Arminda Baptiste, who lost her son to violence in 2016, preceded by Massachusetts State Representative Marjorie Decker. Learn more about Boston's Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, WERU in Blue Hills, Maine, KMEC in Ukiah, California, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.